and a supply of fishing net flown in overnight from the Arctic port of Murmansk, Bocharov improvised a concrete platform poured on top of the debris at level plus 51. A series of hasty loading tests assured the engineers that this foundation would be strong enough to bear the weight of the mammoth. At 10 in the evening on the 1st of November, the massive beam was finally lowered into place. For the first time since the liquidation began, Efim Slavsky was seen to smile. After that, work moved quickly. With the poisonous maw of the reactor finally covered, the shred mash teams installed a ventilation system to stabilize the atmosphere inside the sarcophagus and connected a network of radiation and temperature monitoring devices to a freshly decontaminated room nearby filled with computer equipment. There was still no sign of the missing 180 tons of uranium from the reactor core, and academician Legasov and the other scientists remained concerned about the possibility of a new chain reaction. So inside the new structure, the Sredmash engineers also installed a sprinkler system, supervised by the Kurchatov Institute, designed to spray the ruins with neutron-absorbing boron carbide solution and coat everything with a film to suppress any new criticality as soon as it started. Finally, the roof and windows of the Unit 4 machine hall were layered with steel plates, and the western end of the reactor hall was shored up with a row of 10 massive steel buttresses, each 45 meters high. When Slavsky arrived to survey the project once more on November 13, the sarcophagus was all but complete, a terrible edifice of black angles, still and ominous, which perfectly expressed its purpose, like a medieval fantasy of a prison to hold Satan himself. It was an extraordinary achievement, a technical triumph in the face of horrifying conditions, and a new pinnacle of Soviet gigantomania. The engineers boasted that the structure contained 440,000 cubic meters of concrete, 600,000 cubic meters of gravel, and 7,700 tons of metal. The costs had risen to more than 1 million rubles, or $1.5 million, a day. As he gazed up at his masterpiece, a cathedral of brutalism in concrete and steel, it was said that tears welled in the old man's eyes. It would be Slavsky's final achievement as the leader of the sprawling Sredmash Empire. A week later, Prime Minister Ryzhkov summoned him to his office in the Kremlin and asked for his resignation. Slavsky scribbled a single sentence in his distinctive blue pencil. "I've become deaf in my left ear, so please dismiss me." A truculent parting shot that made clear his feelings about being forced to step down when he felt he had so much more to give. Slavsky was 88 years old and 6 months short of celebrating 30 years as the head of Sredmash. When news of his departure reached the headquarters of the Ministry of Medium Machine Building on Bolshaya Ardinka Street in Moscow, his staff wept with grief. The document formally commissioning the sarcophagus received its final signature on November 30, 1986, just 7 months and 4 days after the first explosions tore through reactor number 4. On December 3, Lev Bocharov completed his tour in the special zone. Winter had come to Ukraine, and the first snow would soon fall on the sarcophagus. He arrived at the railway station in Kiev, muffled in the cold weather jacket and striped undershirt issued to the troops in Afghanistan. With a handful of colleagues, Bocharov boarded the overnight train to Moscow, carrying a large cardboard box filled with bottles of vodka. On the way home, they all had a drink. When the train pulled into Moscow early the following morning, Bocharov thought they would be greeted at the station like conquering heroes, but there were no crowds on the platform to meet them. He saw only his wife, a friend who had driven her in his car to collect him, and a soldier back from the Afghan quagmire who recognized the engineer's fur-collared camouflage. "Kandahar?" the soldier asked. "Chernobyl," Bocharov said. The soldier put an arm around his shoulder. "Brother, you had a tougher job." 17. The Forbidden Zone. By the beginning of August 1986, the number of graves in the special section of the clean new cemetery near the village of Matino in the suburbs of Moscow had risen to 25. They stood in two rows, 50 meters from the yellow-tiled crematorium at the entrance, with space for more. Some had white marble headstones with inscriptions lettered in gold and adorned with the Soviet star. Others, so fresh that they were little more than dirt mounds, were scattered with flowers and marked with pieces of cardboard. Crows circled overhead. When inquisitive Western reporters made the trip out to the graveyard and tried to record the names of the dead, police officers confiscated their notebooks and silently led them away. In September, Dr. Angelina Guskova announced that a total of 31 men and women were now dead as a direct result of the explosion and fire in Unit 4 of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. This number would henceforth be regarded as the official death toll of the accident. Anything higher was treated as evidence of bourgeois Western propaganda. The body of pump operator Valery Khademchuk, killed immediately by the blast or by falling debris, remained buried beneath the wreckage of the reactor hall. His colleague Vladimir Shashinok, who had died as a result of physical trauma and thermal burns a few hours later in the Pripyat hospital, had been laid to rest in the graveyard of a small village near the power station. Since then, 29 more victims, operators, firemen, and security staff, had succumbed to the effects of acute radiation syndrome in the radiology wards of Kiev and the specialized clinic in Moscow. Of the 13 patients who had been treated with bone marrow transplants by Robert Gale and the Soviet specialists, all but one had died. So many that Guskova would eventually dismiss the technique as useless for managing ARS. Yet many of those who had sustained terrible injuries in the first hours of the disaster, after months of agonizing treatment in Hospital No. 6, had at last begun to recover. Deputy Chief Engineer Anatoly Dyatlov, who had insisted on proceeding with the fateful turbine experiment over the objections of his subordinates, and then spent hours wandering in disbelief through the wreckage of Unit 4, had sustained ghastly beta radiation burns on his lower legs and absorbed a total dose of 550 rem, but was released from the hospital at the start of November. He returned to Kiev and soon after was arrested and placed in pretrial detention. Major Leonid Teliatnikov, who had commanded the Chernobyl plant's fire brigade on the night of the accident, had not been told about the deaths of his men until July, when he was released from isolation to walk the halls of the hospital unaided, wearing a gauze mask to protect him from infection. In August, he was discharged and sent to recuperate at a resort on the Latvian coast with his wife and two children, but told to avoid too much sunshine and fatty foods because of radiation damage to his liver. The following month, he had recovered sufficiently to visit his parents in Kazakhstan. The doctors regarded the survival of some of the most badly exposed operators as almost miraculous. One electrical engineer, Andrei Tormozin, had been only 120 meters from the reactor when it exploded, and then spent hours in highly radioactive areas of the machine hall, working to stop feed pumps and extinguish oil fires. He had absorbed what Guskova and the other specialists had always understood to be a mortal dose of gamma and beta radiation, almost 1,000 rem. His body rejected a bone marrow transplant, he contracted blood poisoning and radiation-induced hepatitis, and was not expected to live. But at the end of May, his blood counts began to rally, and for reasons the doctors could never fully explain, he eventually made a complete recovery. Alexander Yuvchenko, who had listened as the machines sustaining his friends in adjacent rooms fell silent one by one, had himself lingered close to death throughout the month of May. For weeks, his wife Natalia woke each morning in a nearby hostel, fearing what might have happened overnight, and asked her mother to phone the hospital. Superstitious, Yuvchenko hoped that if she didn't call the doctors herself, the news about her husband's condition would be better. When his bone marrow function collapsed, the physicians kept him going with blood transfusions, and Natalia scoured the city for scarce and expensive ingredients to keep up his strength. She brought black caviar sandwiches to his bedside. His friend Sasha Karol came to visit and insisted he try ketchup instead. But Yuvchenko proved unable to eat anything, and he was placed on an IV. It was June before Yuvchenko's bone marrow began functioning again. The first white cells reappeared in his bloodstream, and it seemed certain he would live. But it also seemed possible that the radiation burns, especially the ones on his arm and shoulder, would never heal fully, and the surgeons had to cut away repeatedly at both skin and muscle to remove the rotting black tissue from his shoulder blade. The agonizing open wounds left where beta particles had eaten into the flesh of his elbow made it unlikely he would ever be able to live a normal life again. But in the second half of September, the doctors allowed Yuvchenko to go home for a short time, to the new apartment his family had been granted by the government, in a well-heeled neighborhood near Moscow State University. He looked gaunt and skinny and had become addicted to the narcotics the doctors had used to stifle the terrible pain of his burns. While the doctors wanted to wean Yevchenko off the painkillers, they also had to encourage him to learn how to live for himself after weeks of around-the-clock care. But the radiation was far from finished with him. New burns continued to reveal themselves on his legs and arms, even months after the explosion, and he was admitted once more to Hospital Number 6 for further treatment. While the surviving victims of ARS lay in their beds in Moscow, the evacuees from Pripyat remained in limbo, not knowing if or when they might return to their homes in the abandoned Atomgrad. Just outside the exclusion zone, in the town of Polyeska, thousands of the displaced citizens, without clean clothes or money, outfitted themselves in whatever they could, including bathrobes and the white overalls of nuclear plant workers. Their belief in the power of vodka to protect the body against radiation led them to break down the doors of the settlement's liquor store, and Samagon was soon changing hands for up to 35 rubles a liter, the price of a good cognac in Kiev. In the meantime, the state struggled to provide them with new jobs and schools for their children. In May, the Soviet Red Cross Society contributed a one-off payment of 50 rubles per person to every refugee from the catastrophe. Later that month, the Soviet government provided a further lump sum of 200 rubles for every member of each family of displaced people. 15 cashiers distributed the millions of rubles this required, the cash brought in bags from the bank to a municipal office in Polyeska each morning under the eyes of militia officers armed with machine guns. And still, throughout June and July, the people returned to the offices of their city council in exile on Sovietska Street in the town of Chernobyl to ask, "When can I go home?" On July 25, they received an answer. That morning, the first busloads of Pripyat evacuees set out to return to their city, but only as part of an official program to reclaim what they could from their apartments and seek compensation for what they could not. Arriving at a checkpoint on the perimeter of the 30-kilometer exclusion zone, they were issued cotton overalls, shoe covers, pedal respirators, and thick polyethylene bags. After a document check at the entrance to Pripyat, they were permitted to spend 3 or 4 hours in their abandoned apartments and walking the streets of the city, where yellow sand banked against the curbs and grass was already sprouting through cracks in the chalky asphalt. 69 men and women stepped off the buses that first morning, and hundreds more returned every day for months after that to salvage what they could from their former homes. The refugees were allowed to reclaim only property within strictly defined categories. Large pieces of furniture and any object that gathered a great deal of dust, including rugs and TV sets, were prohibited, as were all children's belongings and toys and anything at all that registered radiation readings of higher than 0.1 millirentgen per hour. Both electricity and water supplies to the apartment buildings had been disconnected, and the tart smell of cigarette smoke and human sweat that had once lingered in the stairwells and hallways was already gone. Despite militia patrols and the alarm system fitted at the entrance of each building, many found that their apartments had been looted. Their fridges were filled with the putrefying remains of the food bought in anticipation of the May Day feast at the beginning of the long, hot summer. Some found it hard to hold back tears as they considered their abandoned belongings, standing in musty rooms they now realized they might never see again. It was September when Natalia Yevchenko returned to the two-room flat she and Alexander had shared with their son on Stroitaly Prospect. She found Kirill's stroller, broken and lying outside the entrance to their stairwell, and went upstairs afraid of what she might find. But when she reached the apartment, everything was just as she had left it. The first thing she saw was the forgotten carton of milk that Sasha Karol had brought for the boy on the morning of the evacuation, still resting on the saddle of Alexander's bicycle. She didn't take much but gathered a handful of slides and photographs, including the one of her and Alexander posing in hats on his birthday the year before, and the comic verses that her neighbor had written that night to mark the occasion. Other residents retrieved seemingly random possessions, a plastic bag of science fiction novels, a handful of flatware, in a hurried tussle of utility and sentiment. Each visitor was allowed a maximum of 4 hours inside for deciding what to rescue from their previous life before climbing back aboard the bus to leave. Valentina Bruhanov, by now living at the riverbank Zelone Mus settlement and working double shifts in her job at the plant, while her husband sat in a KGB holding cell in Kiev, recovered her most treasured possessions. A pair of crystal glasses they had been given for their 25th wedding anniversary, a family portrait taken when their son was small, a coveted sheepskin coat which she eventually gave to a neighbor, and a few books which she wiped down with vinegar in the belief that it would help neutralize radiation. It was often late at night by the time each group of visitors returned to the dosimetric checkpoint on the perimeter of the zone, where their belongings were checked by teenaged nuclear engineering students from the MIFI campus in Obninsk. They manned the barriers in all weathers, waving the wands of their radiometers over boxes of china, tape recorders, books, cameras, clothing, and bric-a-brac. When their belongings proved too contaminated to pass, some people tried to bribe their way through with cash, or with the other currency in common use throughout the Forbidden Zone, vodka. The young students were astonished to discover that even former workers from the Chernobyl plant were ignorant of the dangers of radioactive dust, and surprised by furtive strangers who materialized from the shadows to offer cases of alcohol in exchange for a few moments riffling through the piles of confiscated belongings, which they planned to sell in second-hand markets outside the zone. The visits to the deserted city continued for exactly 4 months and ceased on October 25, 1986. By that time, 29,496 people had returned to their apartments in Pripyat. Some had been back more than once, but others hadn't been at all, and their belongings remained unclaimed. The town council planned a program of further trips for the fall of the following year, but the government commission refused permission for these to proceed. A state decree provided for compensation for lost property to be paid to the displaced, a flat payment of 4,000 rubles for a single person and 7,000 for a family of two. At the time, a new car, for anyone lucky enough to find one, cost 5,000 rubles. The Ispolkom received hundreds of applications for compensation every day throughout the summer, and by the end of the year the claims for the domestic property lost by the residents of Pripyat to the ravages of the peaceful atom, and excluding cars, garages, dachas, and motorboats, had reached a total of 130 million rubles. That autumn, the furniture stores of Kiev experienced a prolonged boom in trade, as evacuees attempted to rebuild their lives, beginning with a hollow quest to replace almost every major possession they had ever owned. At first, the plight of those who had been banished from their homes by the fallout from Unit 4 had elicited widespread sympathy across the USSR. At the end of April, the government established a relief fund at the State Bank, named, with traditional Soviet austerity, Account Number 904, into which well-wishers could deposit donations to help support the victims. In May, a charity rock concert, the first ever in the Soviet Union, was held in the Olympic Stadium in Moscow before an audience of 30,000 people, with a live TV link to a studio in Kiev, where miners, plant operators, and other liquidators gathered, and firefighters recited the names of their comrades who had died in the wards of Hospital No. 6. In early August, the chairman of the State Bank reported that account number 904 had already received donations of almost 500 million rubles, sent in by individuals and collectives and drawn from wages, pensions, and bonuses, as well as foreign currency transfers from abroad. But the permanent resettlement of 116,000 people, the specialists and their families evacuated from Pripyat, the residents of Chernobyl, and the farmers from the dozens of small settlements that now fell within the 30-kilometer exclusion zone, all of whom needed new jobs, schools, and homes, was more complicated. In June, the Politburo passed a resolution making the fate of the evacuees a political priority and called on the Republican governments of Ukraine and Belarus to build tens of thousands of new apartments before winter arrived. In Ukraine, 50,000 men and women arrived from all over the republic, and shockwork construction began at once. The first settlement, 150 brick houses near the enormous Gorky Collective Farm, a little more than 100 kilometers south of Chernobyl, was unveiled at an elaborate ceremony in August. Each home was reportedly provided with furniture, gas cylinders, electric light, towels and linens, and a concrete cellar stocked with potatoes. In total, the Ukrainian Republic alone undertook the building of 11,500 new single-family houses, with the intention of completing all of them by October 1. But the Politburo Task Force in Moscow also requisitioned an additional 13,000 newly completed apartments in Kiev and other cities across Ukraine, snatching them from under the noses of families who had spent years on waiting lists and handed the keys to evacuees from Pripyat. Specialists from the Chernobyl plant and their families were transferred to the remaining three Ukrainian nuclear stations in Konstantinovka, Zaporizhia, and Rovno, where they were given new jobs and moved into brand new flats. When they arrived, they were not all welcomed warmly by their colleagues, who saw no justice in having to give up their hard-won places in line to fellow nuclear specialists apparently chased out of their homes by the consequences of their own incompetence. In Kiev, several large apartment construction projects that had been due for completion by winter and would have been ripe for requisition for the evacuees mysteriously came to a halt. In the end, many of the former residents of Pripyat were found homes in the same sprawling complex of high-rise buildings in Troyeshina, a remote and isolated suburb on the northeastern edge of the city. There, they were shunned by their new neighbors, who both resented the refugees and feared the invisible contagion of radioactivity. At school, other children were forbidden by their parents from sharing desks with pupils evacuated from Pripyat, and not without good reason. The radiation readings in the stairwells and hallways of the new apartment blocks in Troyeshina were soon found to be hundreds of times higher than elsewhere in Kiev. Back in Chernobyl, the government commission remained zealously committed to overcoming the handicaps of operating a power station in the heart of the radioactive zone. With the first reactor back online at the beginning of October, the new station director announced plans to have the second generating electricity imminently. Unit 3 remained so contaminated that the plant's chief engineer and specialists from the Kurchatov Institute all advised that it would be too expensive and cost too many operators their health to recommission it. But their objections were overruled, and the third Chernobyl reactor was scheduled for reconnection to the grid in the second quarter of 1987. The commission even issued orders to resume the construction work on reactors 5 and 6, which, although it was close to completion, had been stopped dead on the night of the accident. In the meantime, Pravda reported ambitious plans to build another Atomgrad to accommodate the workers who would operate the resurrected Chernobyl plant and their families. This was to be a new city of the future, fit for the 21st century, located 45 kilometers northeast of Pripyat in the middle of the forest on a remote bank of the Dnieper. Named Slavetich, the city would be filled with modern conveniences and particular care would be taken to integrate it into the natural environment. Planned around a central market square, it would have a statue of Lenin and, nearby, a museum dedicated to the heroes of Chernobyl. In Moscow, the propaganda narrative of the disaster had now crystallized around the gallant sacrifice of the firefighters from the Chernobyl station and Pripyat brigades and their commander, Major Teliatnikov. In September, a photograph of Teliatnikov, still bald from the effects of radiation sickness, appeared on the front page of Izvestia under the headline, "Thank You, Heroes of Chernobyl," and the state media announced that he and General Antoshkin, commander of the helicopter troops, had been granted the state's highest award, Hero of the Soviet Union. The two young lieutenants who had led their men to the roofs of the reactor buildings to pour water on the fragments of fuel assemblies and chunks of blazing graphite, Vladimir Provik and Viktor Kibanok, were given the award posthumously. The leaders of Sredmash US 605, who had built the sarcophagus, were made heroes of socialist labor. Once his auburn hair grew back, Teliatnikov was sent abroad, where he was greeted as a celebrity. He was presented with awards by fellow firefighters in the United States and Britain, interviewed by People magazine, and in London, granted an audience with Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. At a televised award ceremony in January the next year, the grizzled apparatchik Andrei Gromyko, the ceremonial leader of the USSR, delivered a speech in which he lionized the firemen, the liquidators from the armed forces, and the Sredmash construction chiefs who had entombed the smoldering reactor in sand and concrete. "Tens upon tens of millions of people around the world, near and far, followed your shock work with hope," he said. "This feat is a mass feat, a feat of the whole people. Yes, Chernobyl was pain we shared together, but it has become a symbol of the victory of Soviet man over the elements. At the same time, our party renders due tribute to each individual. There are no nameless heroes. Each of them has his own face, his own character, his own specific exploit. Yet some heroes would prove more equal than others. There was still no public acknowledgement for the engineers and operators of the Chernobyl station who had put out the fires and prevented further explosions inside the turbine hall, or for those who had toiled in vain amid lethal fields of gamma radiation to cool the doomed reactor. The few awards granted to plant workers were processed in total secrecy. At one point, Anatoly Dobrynin, the Central Committee Secretary in charge of foreign affairs, came to visit the injured operators in the wards of Hospital No. 6, but the trip went unreported in the press. Instead of recognition of their loved ones' heroism, the families of Alexander Akimov and Leonid Toptanov were notified that under Article 6, Paragraph 8 of the Ukrainian Criminal Code, the accused would escape criminal prosecution for their crimes only on account of their recent deaths. Throughout the winter of 1986, disgraced Chernobyl plant director Viktor Bruhanov remained in his KGB cell in Kiev, awaiting his impending trial. He was permitted no visitors, but once a month his wife Valentina could bring him a 5-kilogram parcel of food, which she packed with sausages, cheese, and butter. Occasionally, Bruhanov had a cellmate, a counterfeiter, or a burglar, but mostly he spent endless weeks in solitude, and passed the time reading books from the prison library and learning English. For a while, Valentina was allowed to bring him English-language newspapers until their son wrote a furtive four-word message to his father inside one of them, "I love you, Daddy." Then that privilege, too, was revoked. At first, Bruhanov refused to retain a lawyer to conduct his defense in court because he understood that the final verdict of the trial had been decided long ago. But his wife persuaded him otherwise, and in December, Valentina traveled to Moscow, where she found an attorney willing to represent Bruhanov, a specialist permitted to act in cases involving the closed facilities of the Soviet nuclear complex, with the top-secret clearance necessary to view evidence gathered behind the Ministry of Medium Machine Building's Wall of Silence. That same month, as part of the discovery procedures dictated by Soviet law, the investigators brought Bruhanov the materials they had uncovered during the course of their inquiries, which would be used in the case against him. Buried among the files, the director found a letter written by one of the Kurchatov Institute experts, which revealed to him the existence of the secret history of the RBMK reactor, the trail of perilous design faults that the scientists had known about all along, but kept hidden from Bruhanov and his staff for 16 years. On January 20, 1987, after Bruhanov had sat in isolation for 6 weeks, poring over the details of his case, the investigators from the prosecutor's office filed their closing indictment with the Supreme Court of the USSR. They sent a total of 48 files of evidence to Moscow, all of which were classified top secret. 15, containing documents taken directly from the plant, were so contaminated with radioactive dust that the lawyers had to wear protective clothing to read them. Bruhanov, along with 4 other senior members of the plant staff, including Dyatlov and Fomin, was charged formally under Article 220, Paragraph 2 of the Ukrainian Criminal Code, under which he was accused of a breach of safety regulations, resulting in loss of life or other serious consequences at explosion-prone plants or facilities. This was an inventive legal gambit. Never before had Soviet jurists considered a nuclear power station an installation likely to explode, and the first of many logical contortions necessary to confine responsibility for the accident to the handful of selected scapegoats. To bolster the case, Bruhanov and Fomin were also charged under Article 165 of the Criminal Code with abuse of power. Bruhanov was accused of deliberately underreporting the radiation readings at the station on the morning of the accident, thereby delaying the evacuation of the station and of Pripyat, and knowingly sending men into the most dangerously contaminated areas of the reactor building. If found guilty, the 3 most senior members of the plant staff each faced a maximum of 10 years in prison. Scheduled to begin on March 18, 1987, the trial was delayed when it became obvious that Deputy Chief Engineer Nikolai Fomin remained too mentally unstable to take the stand. Placed under arrest at the same time as Bruhanov, he had attempted suicide in prison, shattering his spectacles and using the fragments to slash his wrists. While the wretched technician was sent to the hospital to recuperate, the trial was postponed until later in the year. Maria Pratsenko returned to Pripyat for almost the last time in January 1987. Bundled against the cold in a padded cotton jacket and pants, thick felt valenki on her feet, she led a small squad of soldiers up the snow-covered steps of the White House. They went from room to room in the deserted city council building, cleaning out every cupboard and safe, filling sacks with documents too contaminated to be consigned to the archives of the bottomless Soviet bureaucracy, but too sensitive to leave behind. When they had finished, Pratsenko collected the key to every office door in the building, while the soldiers threw the sacks into the back of a truck. Then they drove them away to be buried in one of the growing patchwork of 800 radioactive waste dumps spreading across the exclusion zone. On April 18 that year, local council elections were held for the new Atomgrad in Slavitich, the Pripyat administration was formally dissolved, and the city bureaucratically ceased to exist. After working for almost a full year inside the exclusion zone with barely a day off, Pratsenko was now transferred to a new job in Kiev. In recognition of everything she had endured in the long months since the accident, she was finally permitted to apply for membership in the Communist Party. At the end of the year, Pratsenko checked into a hospital in Kiev and stayed there for more than a month, suffering the symptoms of what the doctors described as nervous tension related to overwork. They marked her medical records with the diagnosis ordinary illness, not related to ionizing radiation. Back in Pripyat, the empty Ispolkom building became the headquarters of the Combinat Industrial Association, a new state enterprise established to manage the long-term research and liquidation efforts within the 30-kilometer zone. Now sole masters of the empty town, the new authority reopened Pripyat's main swimming pool to give the liquidators somewhere to relax and established an experimental farm in the city's hothouses where green-thumbed technicians grew strawberries and cucumbers in irradiated soil. As the cleanup inside the 30-kilometer zone ground on, morale among the tens of thousands of liquidators who had been shipped in to perform the dangerous and apparently inexorable task sank even lower. Dust from highly contaminated areas continued to blow into those that had been cleaned, rendering weeks of work pointless. Combinat appeared to have been making progress in Pripyat until the KGB learned that their specialists had been reporting readings from only the cleanest areas and thus underestimating the true levels of radiation in the city by more than 10 times. The secret policeman also noted that the liquidators' food was bad, radiation safety was lacking, workers weren't even being paid on time, and one radioactive waste dump was being flooded regularly with river water. The Combinat leaders were eventually reprimanded by the party for tolerating nepotism, theft, and drunkenness. In the meantime, looting from inside the zone had begun on an industrial scale, often initiated by the liquidators themselves, and sometimes with the collusion of their commanders. One night, radiation reconnaissance officer Alexander Logachev watched in amazement as a renegade group of soldiers loaded one truck after another with gas stoves and building supplies taken from a heavily radioactive construction warehouse in the shadow of the plant. "Guys, are you fucking crazy?" he asked. But they carried on regardless, and by dawn, two massive Antonov 22 heavy-lift transport aircraft were on their way to the Siberian military district filled with toxic contraband. Lieutenant Logachev himself joined the pilfering soon enough, although he remained sufficiently professional to decontaminate his stolen goods before taking them beyond the perimeter of the zone. In Pripyat, the cars and motorcycles left behind by the fleeing population, more than 1,000 of them in all corralled in the center of town, fell victim to scavengers who stole their windshields and destroyed their bodywork. Some cars had been requisitioned to provide transport for the scientists and technicians within the zone, organized into an improvised motor pool of brightly colored Ladas, Zhigulis, and Moskvichs. The hood and door of each one was painted with a number in a white circle, and details on who was using which one and where were noted in a log that Maria Pratsenko had carefully kept until her last day on the job. The hundreds of vehicles that remained, too contaminated ever to be returned to their owners, were removed to a radioactive waste zone, where they were crushed, bulldozed into a trench, and buried. As the first anniversary of the disaster approached in April 1987, in Moscow the members of the Politburo considered a series of propaganda measures designed to show the USSR's handling of the disaster in the best possible light. The proposals included story ideas for use on TV and in the scientific press and publications for foreign distribution. The official Soviet report to the IAEA had included 70 pages of detailed radiomedical information provided by Dr. Angelina Guskova and her colleagues, including the collective radiation dose they expected the 75 million people in the Western USSR to receive as a result of the accident. But the Soviet report had not forecast the total number of additional deaths or sicknesses the contamination might cause, and Western specialists had filled this gap with estimates that infuriated the Soviet doctors. Robert Gale told the press they could expect to see another 75,000 people die of cancers directly attributable to the effects of the disaster, 40,000 of them within the Soviet Union and the remainder abroad. So, in spite of the increasing freedoms afforded to the editors and producers of the party-controlled media by Gorbachev's Glasnost, in this case, the truth would not be allowed to impede a directive to smash the hostile, prejudiced statements in the Western press. The deputy chief of the USSR State Committee for Radio and Television proposed a list of 26 stories to be carried by the TASS agency, including Birthplace Chernobyl, which followed 300 children born to evacuees from the exclusion zone, showing that they were under constant medical observation with no evidence of illness. What was the scent of the winds of April, in which the chairman of the Soviet Meteorological Agency presented data to refute the idea that dangerous radioactive particles fell on Western Europe, and Pellets of the Spring Marketplace, a report on the spring fruit and vegetables arriving in Kiev, with dosimetry results showing a reassuring absence of radionuclides. The final plan, approved on April 10, included counter-propaganda measures to be sent to Soviet embassies abroad, and a proposal to allow a delegation of foreign journalists to report directly from the exclusion zone. Newspaper reporters from the New York Times and Chicago Tribune finally entered the area in late June to bear witness to the sterile moonscape of concrete and asphalt surrounding the sarcophagus, the desiccated pines of the Red Forest, and the empty streets of Pripyat. Here, more than a year after the accident, the streetlights still came on at night, and operatic music sometimes crackled from the speakers mounted along Kurchatov Street. But the bright pennants that twitched in the breeze above the central square were sun-bleached and tattered, and the laundry on the apartment balconies had begun to rot. Yet still, the authorities maintained the illusion that the city was not dead, but only sleeping, and one morning would be awoken by the footsteps of its returning population. 18. The Trial. The trial of Viktor Bruhanov and the other five men who stood accused of causing the disaster at the Chernobyl Atomic Energy Station began on July 7, 1987. Soviet law dictated that a criminal hearing take place within the same district where the alleged crime occurred. But since Pripyat had become a radioactive ghost town, the proceedings were held in the nearest alternative, 14 kilometers from the plant, in Chernobyl itself. Although subjected to months of decontamination, the city remained at the heart of the 30-kilometer exclusion zone and was accessible only to those issued a government pass. While the trial was nominally open to the public, attendance was therefore restricted to those who worked inside the zone or whom the authorities saw fit to grant entry. Both within the borders of the Soviet Union and beyond, those transfixed by the world's worst nuclear accident awaited justice. But the party did not want its legal pantomime disrupted by an intrusive audience. A handful of representatives of the international press, including correspondents from BBC Radio and Japanese TV, were invited to attend, but would be brought in by bus to witness only the opening and closing of the proceedings, in which nothing but scripted statements would be read. The formerly dilapidated Palace of Culture on the corner of Sovietska and Karl Marx Streets had been refurbished and repainted to provide the venue for the trial. The theater auditorium filled with new chairs, the walls hung with lustrous gray curtains, and a radiation checkpoint installed at the entrance. At 1 p.m., Judge Raymond Brice of the Supreme Court of the USSR took his place on the stage, and the six defendants, escorted by uniformed Internal Ministry troops, stepped into the dock. For 2 hours, they sat and listened as Brice read the indictment aloud. Collectively, the six men stood accused of negligence in conducting a dangerous and unsanctioned experiment on reactor number 4 of the Chernobyl Atomic Energy Station, resulting in the total destruction of the unit, the release of radioactive fallout, the evacuation of 116,000 individuals from two separate cities and dozens of villages, and the hospitalization of more than 200 victims of radiation sickness, of whom at least 30 were already dead. The court also heard that the Chernobyl plant had suffered a long history of accidents that had not been addressed or even reported, and that what had been regarded as one of the best and most advanced nuclear installations in the USSR had, in fact, operated constantly on the edge of catastrophe as a result of its lax and incompetent management. There was no mention of any faults in the design of the RBMK-1000 reactor. All five men accused of breaching the safety regulations of an explosion-prone facility, including Boris Rogozhkin, the chief of the night shift at the time of the accident, and Alexander Kovalenko, the head of the workshop who had signed off on the test, entered pleas of not guilty. But Bruhanov and Fomin admitted to criminal failures in their performance of official duties under Article 165, the lesser offense which carried a sentence of 5 years in prison. "I think I'm not guilty of the charges brought against me," Bruhanov told the court, "but as a manager, I was negligent in some ways." The hearings began at 11 each morning and continued until 7 in the evening, with an hour's break for lunch. The brassy summer heat beat on the low roof of the small brick courtroom, thickening the atmosphere inside with heat and tension. Yet Bruhanov remained as composed and impassive as ever. Wearing a suit jacket but no tie, he sat with his head slightly raised, listening attentively as the witnesses and experts took the stand. He gave an account of his actions on the night of the accident, yet did little to defend himself. He stood by the safety record of the plant and described the impossible nature of his job, the difficulty of recruiting trained staff, and the overwhelming burden of being responsible for every detail of both the plant and the city. And yet he told the court it had been beyond his power to order an evacuation of Pripyat. He had not intended to conceal the true levels of radioactivity. Bruhanov claimed that he had not closely read the critical statement on radiation levels around the plant and town before he signed it. When asked by the prosecutor how he could have failed in such an important duty, he remained silent. During cross-examination, one of the director's fellow defendants asked him if there was any documentary evidence that the plant had ever been categorized as explosion-prone. Bruhanov carefully demurred. "The answer to this question is provided in the investigation materials," he said. Despite all the humiliations and hardships that had befallen him and the apparent inevitability of his fate, Bruhanov remained a creature of the system that had molded him. He understood the role the party expected him to play on the stand, and stuck almost unswervingly to the script. "Who do you think is guilty?" a people's assessor asked. "The court will decide," Bruhanov replied. "Do you consider yourself the principal offender?" said the prosecutor. "I think that the shift personnel are, as well as Rogozhkin, Fomin, and Dyatlov." "But what about you as the senior administrator?"
"Me too."
Chief Engineer Nikolai Fomin, the once imperious party apparatchik, the electrical engineer who had learned nuclear physics by correspondence course, sat before the court a broken man, frowning to himself or staring owlishly away into space. His face pale and glistening with flop sweat, he stood to read aloud from a sheet of prepared remarks. He explained how he had been incapacitated by his car crash months before the accident, staggered under his workload, and appealed in vain to the Ministry of Energy to allow him to restructure the management of the plant. He admitted that he had approved the fateful test program for reactor number 4 without notifying the nuclear safety authorities or the reactor designers in Moscow, and had not even told Bruhanov it was taking place. He described how he had arrived in the bunker at around 4 on the morning of the accident, and yet remained unaware of the scale of destruction or the grievous injuries of his men. The prosecutor said he found the chief engineer's level of ignorance at this moment incomprehensible. When asked who had caused the accident, Fomin replied, "Dyatlov and Akimov, who deviated from the program." Of all the defendants who came before the court, Deputy Chief Engineer Anatoly Dyatlov proved the most confrontational. He sat forward in his seat, rigid and alert, waiting to pounce with questions, corrections, demands, and requests for clarifying references to specific documents and directives. He had an acute command of the technical aspects of the testimony, learned more every day from the information disclosed in evidence, and proved combative and truculent. At one point, when pressed by one of the assembled experts about the reactivity margin of the reactor, he replied, "Is this a physics exam? I'll ask you to answer the question." From the beginning, Dyatlov contended that the Chernobyl operators bore no blame for what had happened to Reactor No. 4 and addressed in detail every one of the charges brought against him. He said responsibility for the accident rested with those who had failed to warn the plant staff that they were operating a potentially explosive reactor and that he personally had given no instructions that violated any regulations. Despite being contradicted by several witnesses, Dyatlov also insisted that he had not been present in the control room of Unit 4 at the crucial moment when Leonid Toptanov let the power of the reactor fall almost to zero before the test, that he had not given orders to raise it, and that he did not send the two now-deceased trainees to the reactor hall to lower the control rods by hand. But it soon became clear that neither the design of the reactor nor the long trail of accidents and institutional cover-ups that preceded the disaster would be considered by the court. Although none of the accused was tortured to confess or brought to the stand to denounce counter-revolutionary activity, no one doubted the outcome of the proceedings. It effectively became one of the final show trials in the history of the Soviet Union. Although the chief prosecutor relied upon the official government commission's accident report to make his case against the operators, he ignored what it had to say about problems with the reactor design. Reporters were told that a separate case against the designers would be prosecuted at a later date. Yet many of the expert witnesses called to the stand were drawn from the very state agencies, including Nikiat and the Kurchatov Institute, responsible for the original design of the RBMK-1000. Unsurprisingly, the physicists absolved themselves of blame, arguing that the quirks of their reactor became dangerous only in the hands of incompetent operators. The court stifled any dissent from this view. When one nuclear specialist began to explain that Toptanov, Akimov, and Dyatlov could not have known about the positive void coefficient that helped precipitate the explosion of the reactor, the prosecutor dismissed him abruptly from the stand. Dyatlov submitted 24 written questions to be put to the expert witnesses about the specifications of the reactor and whether it conformed to the regulations of the USSR's State Committee for Nuclear Safety, but the judge simply ruled them out of order without further explanation. On July 23, the prosecutor delivered his closing remarks. He was merciless. Senior reactor control engineer Leonid Toptanov, who had died of radiation poisoning 3 months short of his 26th birthday, had been a weak specialist. His boss, shift foreman Alexander Akimov, was soft and indecisive and afraid of Dyatlov, who was described as intelligent but disorganized and cruel. The prosecutor regarded the deputy chief engineer as a nuclear hooligan who thoughtlessly broke the canons and commandments of nuclear safety and whose criminal acts were directly responsible for the catastrophe. Chief Engineer Fomin had been in a position to halt the accident before it began, yet failed to do so. But the prosecutor reserved his most caustic assessment for the director of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, who he implied had lied to his superiors in the hope of concealing the magnitude of the accident and clinging to his position, and in so doing, endangered the lives of not only his staff, but also every citizen of Pripyat. "There is no reason to believe that Bruhanov did not know the true radiation situation," he said. The director's behavior revealed the moral collapse of Bruhanov as a leader and as a man. In response, the defendant's lawyers made their own arguments, and the accused spoke for themselves. Bruhanov's lawyer said that his client was a decent man who knew he must assume the blame. They both recognized that, according to the operational regulations of the power station, the director was formally responsible for everything that happened within the plant. But privately, they hoped Bruhanov might escape with only a conviction for administrative negligence and not the more serious charges of abuse of power. Fomin accepted his guilt and pleaded for the mercy of the court. Dyatlov expressed sorrow for the dead and sympathy for the injured, but remained defiant. The three other members of the staff on trial, Rogoshkin, Kovalenko, and Yuri Laushkin, the plant's nuclear safety inspector, asked to be acquitted on all charges. But the Soviet people had been well prepared to expect harsh justice for the men whose corruption and incompetence had despoiled the land of three republics and poisoned thousands of innocent victims. Pravda's science editor, Vladimir Gubarev, had already published Sarcophagus, a Tragedy, a play about an accident at a fictional nuclear plant, in which he laid blame on a broken system, but also upon the station officials. The unnamed director has approved the building of a dangerously flammable roof so that construction can finish on time. And when a radioactive explosion takes place, he evacuates his own grandchildren, leaving the population of his city to their fate. When the decorated firefighter, Major Leonid Teliatnikov, was asked his opinion of the defendants, he was unequivocal. "Of course they should be punished," he said. "According to the government commission, it was human error. It was their fault. The consequences were very severe." Others went further still. During an adjournment in the trial, Valentina Bruhanov waited on a park bench in Kiev beside an old man who had fought in the Great Patriotic War. When talk turned to the Chernobyl proceedings, the veteran explained that some people thought that the defendants should be sent to prison, but in his opinion, that wouldn't be just. He said they should all be shot. On Tuesday, July 29, another fiercely hot day, Judge Bryce delivered his verdict. All six men were found guilty. Yuri Laushkin was given 2 years in prison, Alexander Kovalenko 3, and Boris Rogozhkin 5. All three were taken into custody in the courtroom. Bruhanov, Fomin, and Dyatlov each received the maximum sentence, 10 years confinement in a penal colony. Every one of them remained stoic except Fomin, who wept in the dock. Valentina Bruhanov fainted. Afterward, one of the investigators told her, "Now you can terminate your marriage at any time." Driven from the Palace of Culture in a black van with bars on the windows, the former director of the Chernobyl Atomic Energy Station was sent to serve out his sentence in a penitentiary in Donetsk, in the far east of Ukraine. He was shipped there by rail, aboard one of the Soviet prison system's notoriously barbaric Stolypin cars, and was lucky to survive the journey. During the 2 weeks it took to travel the 700 kilometers, he was sustained mostly by rations of pickled herring. When he finally arrived at the prison, every one of his fellow convicts turned out into the yard to see the face of the infamous culprit behind the world's worst nuclear disaster, a small, frail figure swallowed in drab blue overalls. As the end of 1987 approached, the new Atomgrad for the Chernobyl workers and their families in Slavutich was almost ready to begin receiving its first residents, due to arrive from both the workers' shift camp on the Dnieper and from apartments where they had been living in Kiev. Built at frantic speed and garlanded with publicity, Slavutich had been intended as a showcase for Soviet unity, with 5 districts built in different regional styles by architects from the republics of the Caucasus, Ukraine, Russia, and the Baltic states. But even this prestige project had been dogged by the usual bureaucratic obstructions, construction delays, labor disputes, and slipshod work. At the last minute, the model city's central heating system broke down, rendering it uninhabitable before spring. In preparation for the arrival of the new citizens, in September, a radiation survey of Slavutich had been conducted by scientists from the USSR's Hydrometeorological Monitoring Service, the Ministry of Health, and the Ministry of Defense. They found that the town was being built on land contaminated with cesium-134, cesium-137, ruthenium-106, and cerium-144. The woods nearby contained isotopes of cesium, strontium, and plutonium. They reported that the resulting annual radiation exposure fell within official limits permitted for populations living near nuclear power stations, but recommended asphalting paths, regularly washing streets and yards, and, especially in the surrounding forest where people might be expected to take walks and gather mushrooms, cutting down trees and bagging fallen leaves. On December 4, 1987, after more than 18 months of decontamination, repairs, and modifications, the last of the 3 surviving reactors of the Chernobyl Atomic Energy Station once again began providing electricity to the Soviet grid. Unit 3, although now separated from its entombed twin by a wall of concrete and lead, remained so radioactive that reluctant engineers were rotated in from other reactors to prevent them being overexposed during the course of their shifts. Despite the sacrifices of General Tarakanov and his bio-robots, uranium fuel pellets were still scattered on the roof of the building, and the turbine operators who worked in the machine hall below did so from protective concrete cabins fitted with portholes of lead glass. The three Chernobyl reactors, along with the 12 other RBMK-1000 units operating elsewhere in the USSR, had all been subjected to the extensive technical refit proposed in the secret Politburo resolution the previous July. In what amounted to a tacit admission of the designer's culpability in the accident, each RBMK was now fueled with more highly enriched uranium, modified with scores of extra control rods which reduced the positive void coefficient, and featured a faster and more effective emergency shutdown system. The authorities revised instruction programs for reactor operators and made money available to build computer simulators to prepare them for accident scenarios. Yet little had really changed. More than a year after the disaster, the Politburo received a report showing that Soviet atomic power stations continued to be bedeviled by bad construction, poor staff discipline, and hundreds of minor accidents. At the Chernobyl plant, the operators manning the three remaining reactors were also demoralized by the way their dead colleagues had been blamed for the accident. Although they went to work dutifully every day, many believed the true causes of the disaster had not been properly considered. Some remained convinced that the same thing could easily happen to them. Almost none of them wanted to live in Slavitich. In public, Valery Legasov continued to hold the party line about the safety of the USSR's nuclear industry. He said that he did not fault Soviet reactors, which had been designed to take into account all but the most unforeseeable circumstances. The academician insisted that nuclear power represented the zenith of atomic science and was essential for the future of civilization. But privately, Legasov had been struck by what he had heard Prime Minister Ryzhkov tell Gorbachev and the rest of the Politburo more than a year earlier, that the explosion in Chernobyl had been inevitable, and that if it hadn't happened there, it would have happened at another Soviet station sooner or later. It was only then that Legasov had finally recognized the true scope of the decay at the heart of the nuclear state. The culture of secrecy and complacency, the arrogance and negligence, and the shoddy standards of design and construction. He saw that both the RBMK reactor and its pressurized water counterpart, the Vavier, were inherently dangerous. He began to investigate the problems in more detail and advocated at Sredmash for a new generation of reactor, cooled with molten salt. But his suggestions were met with fury and indignation. F.M. Slavsky, at that time still head of the Ministry of Medium Machine Building, told Legasov he was technically illiterate and should keep his nose out of matters that didn't concern him. By then, Legasov's health problems had intensified, and over the following year he made repeated visits to Hospital No. 6, where he was treated for neurosis, erratic white blood cell counts, and problems with his heart and bone marrow. Although the doctors made no formal diagnosis of acute radiation syndrome, the scientist's wife had no doubt what was happening to him. Nonetheless, inspired by the rising winds of perestroika, Legasov now went to work on a series of proposals to modernize the monolithic structures of Soviet science. The report he delivered to his colleagues at the Academy of Sciences challenged the hegemony of some of the most powerful forces of the state, and to anyone else would have appeared an obvious political risk. He proposed that the Ministry of Medium Machine Building should be broken up into smaller units that would compete with one another in an internal market, that the research of the Kurchatov Institute should be funded with a new rigor focused on practical results, and that the old men who now controlled its budgets and made all the appointments to its many jobs for life should be replaced with younger and more vital scientists. Legasov had good reason to believe the report would be well received. Not only had he distinguished himself in the liquidation of the Chernobyl disaster and in defending the reputation of the nuclear industry in Vienna, he was, after all, also Alexandrov's anointed successor to lead the Kurchatov Institute and had powerful backing within the Politburo. Yet Legasov's proposals were ignored. He failed to realize that he and his ideas would alienate not just the old guard, whose comfortable positions in the status quo he threatened, but also his more reform-minded colleagues, who saw Legasov as a creature of the era of stagnation, with a privileged background that had eased a frictionless rise to the top. Even his role at Chernobyl became controversial, as his fellow scientists began to question the wisdom of the operation to cover the burning reactor with sand and lead. In the spring of 1987, the Central Committee of the Communist Party ordered that the staff of the Khrushchev Institute